Okay, we're at 7:30, so I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to mute all. As always, everybody has the ability to unmute themselves. Please feel free to do so if you have a comment or a question. Remute yourself afterwards to keep background noise to a minimum. And welcome all. Welcome to any guests we have with us. I have pasted into the chat. If you want to join or just come to our website and click on the join or renew at the top bar. And, yeah, it's $20 a year. And if you join in the next couple of weeks or before the end of March, you'll get 2 years for the price of one. And I think that's all the announcements I have. So I will... just reminder that the contents of the deck in PDF format, the audio track, and the contents of the chat window will go up on the website probably later on this evening. And with that, we got a lot of slides to get through, so I'll turn it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck. Alan, take it away.
And we will get right to it. Now, we've got a bunch of follow-ups. A lot of these are questions that came in to the as a result of the survey that we sent out. It was basically what was the one thing that people wanted to know about computers. And one of the questions that came in was this business of what's a good password manager would work with both Windows 11 and an iPhone. And there's a lot of discussion in the chat, and I pulled out these were the suggestions that people made: Bitwarden, LastPass, 1Password, and Chris, and my personal favorite is KeePass, which is a cross-platform Linux and Windows and Android, actually, solution.
And BlackBerry, even.
So if you're looking for a password manager that will work all kinds of places, then these are some of the things that you can check out. Another question was what AI tools could be used with a scanner to pull out things from photographs or documents and then save them to files. And again, in the chat, I think it was Carl who suggested Abby Fine Reader. He says he's used it quite a lot with impressive results. Doesn't know about AI integration, but it is a proprietary commercial package and can be fairly expensive, I guess. The third one we've got here is that TD Bank has a pop-up when you log on. It asks you to, deal with cookies, and lots of websites these days are doing this. They want you to accept all the cookies or deny all the cookies or only accept the necessary cookies or fiddle around with your cookies. There's all kinds of different things. And the question was, how could that? That was one example, but all the others, how can you deal with them? And my suggestion was that some of the sites, and TD Bank seems to be one of them, it pops up a window that looks a bit like this on the left, and everything is checked, send me all the cookies. But if you turn them all off, except for essential, which they won't let you do anything with, and then do a confirm settings, then TD Bank seems to honor that, and it seems to work okay. This is a different website, some store, I think. They do the same thing. I don't know whether everybody does. Anybody knows the answer to all of those questions, we appreciate it. Tom had some suggestions for using software, basically blocking software, U-Matrix or U-Block Origin, to stop the cookie pop-up, or to use DNS filtering, and OpenDNS is one thing that you could do that for.
Alan?
Yes, go ahead.
That was my original question. So I finally called TD Bank, and it's actually the Firefox browser was kept making, because I don't know whether I have my security or I have blocked pop-ups, but when I opened it on a different browser, I think it was on the Microsoft one, it went fine and there was no pop-up. So there was something about the browser and what as you said, I would have had to change some setting or privacy setting or something, but it worked fine on another browser. So
Yeah, well, that kind of marries with my experience. So I used Vivaldi, and it worked fine on Vivaldi.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it could be a browser-related thing.
Thank
good
you.
Reason to have multiple browsers on your computer. I ran into a problem where if I log into Alterna Savings, they don't have two-factor authentication, so the next best thing is to have them notify me when any successful login happens. And if I log in using Chrome, I get about 4 emails saying a successful login occurred. If I use any other browser, I get 1. So I stopped using Chrome to log into Alterna. So if you're having problems with one browser, try another.
Okay, the next follow-up is yours, Chris.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, Snitcher.space, this is kind of an interesting, intriguing tale, I guess. I reported on this service last July, and basically what it is that if you get any email and you suspect that maybe it's a scam or spam, you could actually forward the email to a specific email address there, and then you would get an analysis of that email that would tell you whether they thought it was a scam and why and so forth. And it was all completely free, and, you know, they had all kinds of privacy notes that sounded real good. And I tried it, and it worked for a while, and then all of a sudden it stopped replying to me, and I never bothered to even look back to see why I was no longer getting analysis emails. But an interesting thing was I got an email on the 20th of February saying that Snitcher.space was shutting down, but that they were switching over to this new service, EML Scanner, and it was going to be completely local to your computer. So you'd install an app, and everything would be done locally. And I thought, oh, that sounds pretty cool. And so from the ashes of Snitcher.space comes EML Scanner. And some of the highlights on it are on the screen, and you can see a scan report, and they found red flags and all that sort of thing. So it was doing good analysis of it. And, you know, they, on their website, they did say, you know, it was, you know, 100% local processing, which I kind of like. Now it was no longer a free ride. So Snitcher.space was free, but this, they had a monthly fee of $10 US, or a lifetime at $50. And I thought, a monthly at $10 is really, really expensive. A lifetime at $50, maybe not too bad. But keep in mind, when people talk about lifetime, they talk about the lifetime of their company, not the lifetime of you or your computer or anything else. So you always have to take that with a little bit of a grain of salt, how long are they going to actually stay in business. Then 10 days later, I got a new email, and it said, oh, there's this new service. And, you know, so it, I looked at this, and they said basically what we're going to is forward your email to a specific email address. And so they've gone away from this whole idea of a locally installed app that will do it all on your computer and not send anything to the internet after 10 days. So it was this return to an online-only service. So let's take a look at a couple of things. I had an obvious scam here, and so I decided to try that new service. It was obvious that this was not from Amazon. It was from a, you know, Brazil2.biz.id email address, so that's pretty obvious. If I hovered the mouse over the button they wanted me to click on, it took me to a Google Docs rather than to Amazon. So to me, it was like real, real obvious that this was a scam. So the report I got back after submitting it to the new online service, you know, they said it's likely a phishing attempt. Yeah, so it contains suspicious characters. They didn't highlight anything but the fact that it didn't come from Amazon or things like that. They had 5 negative trust assessments and 1 positive trust assessment. And, you know, you can read the details about what they thought about it. And they had no indicators of trust. And then they did caution, don't click links and so forth, like, which probably shouldn't do anyways. So this one here scored 43 out of 100. I think it should have scored about 0 out of 100. Then another one, pretty obvious spam. And in this case here, it came up with a score of 50 out of 100. And 2 negative trust assessments, 4 positive assessments, and they said you shouldn't respond to it. So it didn't report on very poor grammar in it. It didn't report on the fact that it's definitely not professional looking. You know, it could be that it's a fly-by-net operation, or they're trying to trick people into for other scams and things like that. I think that should have scored way lower than 50. What about a non-spam or scam? So this is Airvol. They do sleep apnea machines and masks and things like that. And so I'm on their mailing list, so I do trust that what came in. Interestingly, same score and assessment as something that, to me, was a really obvious scam. So it got 50 out of 100 as well. And it didn't report on the fact that it actually looked really good, good grammar, typical-looking marketing email, came from an email address that matched the rest of the email and so forth. So to me, the fact that those two came up with 50 was not really a good indicator to me. I think that should have scored way higher than 50. So bottom line, I think Cincher.space, it's been replaced with essentially an identical service. So you forward the suspicious emails to an address and you get an analysis back by email. So you can do it for free. So you get 3 scans a day max. And they actually say that it is not their most powerful AI model and not the highest accuracy. I can sort of attest to that. The basic at $10 US a month, that to me is pretty expensive. $20 a year is really expensive, and they don't have a lifetime pricing anymore at all. And so I emailed the author, and I mentioned that I thought it was pretty fast switch. In 10 days, they went from a locally installed program back to an online service, and they said it didn't last very long because it was Windows only, kept everything local, which ended up alienating most users. I don't know about that. People wanted the convenience rather than privacy. Not sure about that either. I told him I was surprised about the poor scoring, and he says that maybe it was just a little trigger happy, and they're still tweaking things and things like that. And I said I thought the pricing was high for most users, and I suspect most would just stick with the free tier. And he replied that he dropped the price 60%. So the monthly is now $4 US a month, and the annual is $8 a month, which I think is still a lot for this type of service. So I would like to throw out, I told him I would ask, because he asked me, he says, well, what do you think is a fair price? And I said, well, quite frankly, I don't pay for services like that, but I would throw it out. And if there's anybody on the call tonight who wants to throw in their opinion about what it would actually be worth for a service like that, by all means, throw it into the chat, and I will pass the words back to the author. And that's all I've got on that.
Okay, thanks, Chris. And then the next one is basically yours, too.
Okay, yeah, I'll take the whole thing then. So this was something that came in. Why is that number? There we go. Restore points. So somebody asked, they weren't sure what restore points really are, and is it a backup? And so we have talked about restore points a couple of times in the past, and I will paste these into the chat right now. So we have talked about them before in a little bit, and so I decided to do up a little bit more information about what restore points really are. What it is, it backs up certain key aspects of Windows. It will do it automatically before you have a Windows update, if you have it enabled. It'll do it before a Windows update occurs and before, quote-unquote, according to Microsoft, some program installations. I don't know how they decide what program installations would trigger restore points, whether it's part of the installation process that authors can trigger automatically. I don't know. You can also do it on a schedule. So optionally, you can go in, you can say you want restore points created once a week, once a month, once a year, whatever you want. So what is a backup? So it backs up the Windows system files. So this is a big thing with Windows Update. So when Windows Update kicks in, it will replace a lot of the Windows files themselves. So it'll back up those so that if you roll back, it'll get back the older versions that were in place before the update. It will also do the registry hives for system-level information. So it doesn't back up the user level registry highs, where a lot of the configuration information about your settings in programs occur and things like that. It does not back up any of those. So the intent behind restore points is not a backup. What it is really to get you back to a running version of Windows. So if something gets changed at the system level, like a driver update or some key component of Windows gets changed during Windows update, and all of a sudden Windows won't load. So the intent with restore points is to get you back to the point where Windows is running. It's not going to save your data and things like that. It's just trying to get you back up functioning. So if Windows fails to start properly, it generally will offer to use a restore point to try to recover back to a working state. It'll restore from this chosen restore point. You might have multiple restore points on your computer. So it'll give you back those older versions of the system files and drivers that have been replaced as part of either the app install or Windows update. It'll restore the registry files that were saved. And those things are probably most likely to be the cause and the solution to get Windows up and running again. So restore points are actually a good thing. I've had them save me once. I used to think that they never did anything worthwhile, but I've heard from quite a few people saying that a restore point did save their bacon. They're not a complete solution for when you're trying to recover everything. It's not a replacement for backup. It doesn't save the state of anything beyond what it promises it will do. Okay, so just keep that in mind. They will automatically be removed if Windows decides that restoring a system to a given restore point would actually cause instability because something that got installed after it. It will figure that out, and it will automatically remove those so that, again, they're interested in the stability of Windows. They don't want you to restore from a restore point where it will cause more problems than it solves. So it has worked for people to get Windows running again. And so the default is to have it on, as far as I know. If we want in the future, I could actually do a little bit of a run-through of enabling or disabling it and how to actually work with it. But it's fairly straightforward to actually work with restore points. And that's all I have on that.
There's a comment in the chat from Tom. There's no question mark, so I imagine it's a statement. He says, it also backs up app executable and program files.
Not according to everything that I've read.
And the current system state.
Yeah, the current system state is the registry hives other than current user, or any of the user hives are not backed up. But my understanding is that it does not back up application executables and program files other than the ones that come with Windows. That's everything that I've read on it.
Okay, well, Tom, you have a source for that. I guess you can put it in the chat. Continuing then, a question again from the survey, basically about setting up a new computer. How do I manage my computer after buying a PC, and I want to start off in a better way than I did in the past. So one of the things I do is refer you to the newsletter a number of years ago, 2021, I guess. Chris and I did this mini-series in the newsletter on setting up a new computer, things that you can start with, backing up and updating, and also keeping things up to date. So there are three articles there which cover a lot of those things. And personally, my specific suggestions here, as it says, and the first thing I would do, I do in fact, is make an as-received disk image. So before I do anything with my computer, I make a full disk image of the computer. So I have as-received, as-purchased, whatever you want to call it, before I play around with it. And to do that, I use Foxconn because that's a bootable USB, and I don't have to install anything. I can just use a live USB, make my backup onto an external USB, And so I've got my as-received version. The other major thing I do is I create this log file. And I maintain a log file for every computer I have. And to start off with, I record all of the serial numbers and configuration type things which are important for that particular computer. So I can always go back to that if things break down. And then carrying on from that, you'll see down the bottom here, and once there's my image, my that would be my as received image probably. And then once I start changing things, then I keep this maintenance log of all the changes that I make to the system as I go along. So if I need to do something a second time, like install printer drivers or scanner drivers or something, I can always go back and find out how I did it last time. So I find that very useful. I use a password manager. As I said earlier, I use KeePass. And in that, I keep all my login IDs for various websites and a Windows password. I do keep a Windows account, though. If I happen to need it, I never use it, but I have it, so I maintain that in my password manager. I also create a specific data partition. As well as the drive C, I have a data partition where all of my personal files, spreadsheets, documents, images, digital photographs, computer programs, whatever I develop, I keep on this data partition, so I keep it completely separate from Windows and the installed applications which are on Drive C. And that same data partition I can access from my Linux partition as well. I generally do a full antivirus scan of these two drives. And if you do a full scan, then you can basically assure yourself that your system is clean. And then the on-access scanner, when you read and write files to the disk, the on-access scanner will make sure that things stay clean and use a third-party AV scanner every now and again just to check on things. And now once I've got everything installed, I do another full disk image backup so that I have all my installed applications, all my configuration settings. Everything now is in the second backup image, which I can go back to and basically don't have to do all that stuff over again. And then I create a backup schedule for various things. I tend to do a monthly full backup of the system because that kind of aligns itself with Windows updating itself once a month on Patch Tuesday. I have a system that does a daily incremental backup of my data. I'm not terribly concerned about Windows and the installed apps because they don't change very quickly. So I can go back to my monthly and then just update things. That's okay. But my data tends to change all the time. So I like to have at least a daily backup. And then I also have my active data files on this drive D. I can back those up to a USB flash drive using FreeFileSync. And I do that manually every time I close down my computer. Just before I do that, I run FreeFileSync, which is kind of an incremental backup, but it's just kind of a snapshot of the data drive as it is right now. So it's totally current until I change things tomorrow. And I also use QuickShadow Backup, which is a real-time synchronization program, and it syncs the data drive to an SD card, which is plugged into the machine all the time. So I've got all kinds of systems to keep things up to date. So those are the kind of things that I would suggest if you have a brand new machine. It's a good way to set you off on the right road, I guess. And Chris has a story
before we go on. Corinne asks, where do you save the maintenance files?
The maintenance file is in my data drive, so it gets backed up to the flash drive.
Okay.
So that's the maintenance log, right?
Yeah, maintenance log, yeah.
The image files are on an external USB.
Yeah, okay. And Harvey asks, do you change the location of the library folders to your G drive?
I don't use Labitholus, so no.
Okay.
I mean, that's things like documents and pictures and...
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't use any of those, so...
Okay.
Everything I do is on the G drive.
You just manually specify it when you're saving files and that?
Correct.
Yeah, okay.
And do it as default.
Yeah.
So, for example, in LibreOffice, the D drive is my default drive to save files.
Right, okay. Okay, yeah, I think that's all the questions we had in the chat. So this is a little thing I have here for a one-on-one remote assistance success story. So we received a request for assistance, and I will say that this is a little bit out of the ordinary for what one-on-one remote assistance was originally envisioned to be. It was never really envisioned to be a general tutorial type thing. It was more, you know, to fix specific issues that people are running into and things like that. But we had this request come in for setting up a new computer and information on apps to be installed, emails, browsers, things like that, and asking if somebody would be able to help out. And I kicked that over to the volunteer group, and Harvey Hope jumped into the breach and said he would be happy to help out. So it went for, I forget how many hours it was that was spent on it, but a considerable amount of time was spent on it, but it was closed out successfully. And one of the things we do request from the people who put in a request for one-on-one remote assistance is that they answer some questions after the engagement. So how did the engagement go? And I highlighted some of the things there, but you can read them all. Went very smoothly. It said Harvey was very knowledgeable and patient. Ask, was the item resolved to your satisfaction? And it was beyond expectations. And given what the person learned from Harvey, they feel confident they'll continue to be able to learn and manage the PC. And we also asked, could anything have been done better? And the respondent was, it was brilliant, cannot offer any suggestions for improvement, and they're grateful to members of the OPCUG. Keep in mind that this one-on-one remote assistance is available only to members. So thanks, Harvey. You're a star. And I would also, we've had 10 other one-on-one remote assistance calls that went in. One of them was a vendor problem that nobody would have been able to solve. And one of them, we had four people look at it, and nobody actually came up with a solution for it. But, hey, one out of 11 that we couldn't solve, not too bad. So the previous requests, they were worked on by Alan, myself, Jocelyn, and Stefan. So star to all of those people, as well as anybody else who's on our volunteer list, standing by ready to receive any requests that they think they may be able to help out with. So details for one-on-one remote assistance if you're not familiar with it. So the URL is there, and I will have to get that in a minute to paste it in. You can find it on our homepage anyways. You send in a request for assistance to that email address, and then the request will get sent out to the group of volunteers. And if any of the volunteers thinks that they can help with your particular problem, they jump in and say, okay, I'll take that one. And then we basically hand that off, and it's up to the volunteer and the requester to talk it out, figure out when they can work on the problem, things like that. Typically what it means is the volunteer does connect remotely to the requester's computer using either Zoom or Microsoft Quick Assist, and then the volunteer can see your screen. And optionally, you can give them control of your keyboard and mouse. Often problems come down to the fact that, you know, something that you didn't think was really related shows up on the screen or in the settings somewhere, and the volunteer can actually see that and say, oh, okay, there's where the problem really lies, and help sort out the problem. So hopefully the problem gets resolved, and then the requester provides feedback on the process. So question, can you help? So we do have a number of volunteers. But if you have, you know, detailed knowledge about any particular computer program or operating system or anything like that at all, and if you're willing to share your expertise on a case-by-case basis, it'll get problems sent out, and if you think that you can help out, then you jump in and you say, yeah, I'll take that one. So we are looking for volunteers all the time to join our quote-unquote expert panel who can provide assistance. And if you want to volunteer, just send in an email to suggestionbox@opcug.ca. Say that, yes, you're willing to be a volunteer, and here's your area of expertise. Or you could have it just generally anything, or you'll lurk and watch for anything interesting that comes by that you think you can help with, whatever at all. You know, be happy to take it on. And that's it. So once again, well done, Harvey. That was really great, that job you did on that one. And the person was obviously very, very satisfied with the outcome.
Okay, thanks so much, Chris. Next up here, this is an article from Stuart. This is a new release from Apple, the MacBook Neo. It's a 13-inch laptop. And it looks kind of interesting. And as Stuart says, there's a lot of buzz about it. Quite a few reviews are saying this is really quite a neat little machine. It's a 13-inch laptop, and they're using the chip that they also use in the latest iPhone. But the price is kind of reasonable for the specs, $800 in Canadian dollars, and for quite a nice little laptop. So if anybody's looking for a small laptop, that's worth looking at, I think. Okay, next up, Chris has another of his keyboard shortcuts.
Yeah, keyboard shortcut number 5. So the aim of these keyboard shortcut ones are very quick and easy to digest things that maybe some people are not aware of. And the idea is to get away from, you know, clicking with your mouse. So reaching away from the keyboard, reaching with your mouse, pointing at something, clicking on it, and maybe just keeping your hands on the keyboard, you can accomplish the same thing a lot easier and faster. So the shortcut today is resizing columns in File Explorer. So you see the example there, and there's two columns that are too narrow, so we're not seeing all the information. And then we have two columns that are too wide, so there's a lot of white space being given up. Now you can go on to the header, and you can actually, where it says name, date modified, type, and size, you can put your mouse on the divider and drag them back and forth, and you can resize each of the columns individually. But a faster way is, rather than doing that resizing manually, just hit Control and the plus key, and it's got to be the plus on the numeric keypad only. So if you're on a laptop, you're probably out of luck. But if you do that, the example above would automatically show up like this, where all columns get resized to the longest data in that particular column. So Control plus, very handy keystroke that you can use to speed your way through seeing information on screen.
Oh, one other thing, Chris. You can also do this by, if you right-click on the columns, you'll get two choices to size this particular column or size all columns to fit. So that's another alternative.
No, it's not, because this is keyboard shortcuts. Thanks, Tom. Okay, I think the next one is me as well. So nearby glasses, I came across this, kind of interesting. And let me paste this into the chat before I forget about it totally. Smart glasses are, I don't know if they're really becoming more and more of our daily lives, but there are more and more companies that are selling them. And the early ones were really, really ugly, and you wouldn't mistake them for regular glasses, but they are getting a little bit more discreet, shall we say. And so this is an app that will display a notification when there are smart glasses that are nearby. And they say, hence, you may act accordingly. So it's up to you to interpret that. But it's free, open source, doesn't track you, doesn't contain ads, anything like that. But there is an author's note on there, and it says, harassing somebody because you think they're wearing covert surveillance could be a criminal offense, may even be more serious offense than using smart glasses. And they recommend seek legal advice regarding your local laws on this matter. So when you say act accordingly, might not be go up and punch the person in the face. And that's all I have on that.
Carry on. Next one.
Oh, next one's mine too. Okay. Canadian Tire had a data breach, And so I'm registered at haveibeenpwned.com. And so I got an email, and it told me that Canadian Tire data breach happened, and it gives me details about it. So there was 38.31 million accounts that were actually affected by it, and you could see the data that was actually stolen by the attackers. And I had actually really, I had totally forgotten I even had an account at Canadian Tire. I rarely shop there, and yeah, very, very rarely online. I'll go in store, but you know, logging onto that account, it was probably years that I had last signed on. So what did I do when I got that email? I went in, signed in on Canadian Tire, I changed my password, and if I hadn't had two-factor authentication already on, I would have turned it on, but actually I already did have two-factor authentication. So what I recommend anybody who has a Canadian Tire account, do that, go on, change your password, and turn on two-factor authentication, and that will strengthen things immensely for the future. And highly recommend it. Go to haveibeenpwned.com, and you can look up an email address, but you can also sign up for future breaches, which I did, which is what caused me to get an email from Have I Been Pwned indicating that this had actually happened. So if you sign up for that, you will get notified in the future. And next one's mine. yeah, okay, so in the event of any breach notification, these are the sort of things you should typically look for. Sign in at the site, change your password. If you have security questions that will allow you to do a password reset, make sure you change the answers to those security questions. Turn on two-factor authentication if they have it available. More and more sites are making two-factor authentication available. And then also be really, really wary of any emails you get that are saying they came from that particular site or service because it could be the scammers trying to get you to give up information. Any chat stuff on that? I guess not. Okay. So this is another thing I just came across that I thought was kind of interesting, Web Rewind. This was actually created by Opera, the browser people, and it's an interactive journey through 30 years of the web. And so if you want to look at, gee, what was it like in the old days, like when we had dial-up, it's a mildly interesting site that you can browse through with lots of animations and things like that. So just something that you can check out if you're interested.
Okay, thanks, Chris.
That's it for me.
Okay, so Tom wants to know the rules of the competition. So we are having this competition. No, I shouldn't say that. We're proposing to have this competition, and assuming that we get people entering it. Clearly, we're not going to have a competition if there's no entries. And the idea is to create an application, some kind of application that is useful to you, using exclusively vibe coding. So you tell a chatbot what you want to do, it does the coding, and if it doesn't do exactly what you want to do, you tell it something else, and you go around that lap several times until you've got a piece of code that has the application or the script or whatever it is, or the web page, whatever it is you're developing, and that works the way you want it to. So it's AI, so we're not going to be able to check whether you do anything else other than vibe coding, but it's going to be on the honor system. We're going to assume that you use vibe coding as you said you did. And there are going to be two prizes. One is going to be what is judged somehow. I don't know how we're going to judge all this stuff yet, but what is the most useful product that somebody has developed? And the second one, for people who aren't very successful doing it or whatever, as long as you have a good story to tell us about the development process, and we're going to have the apps presented as part of a monthly meeting. So the best presentation will be a second prize. And so your program could be an abysmal failure, but if you've got a really good story to tell us, then you might win the second prize instead. So those are the only three things I think right now that we know about. The only other thing I'll mention is the board has agreed that this process is going to be open to non-members. So you don't have to be a club member to join the competition. So all you people out there from Durham in Australia or wherever you find it. I saw some different in the U.S. And if you're interested in joining our competition, then Vibe Coding. I think I've done one example already, maybe two actually. Yeah, I've done two examples already. One was developing a simple web page, and the other one was extracting text from one of these log files that I use using a regular expression search program. So this is an example of scripting, and it's not Windows. I'm using an example from my Linux box. And basically, the situation is right here. It's when when a new version of Linux comes out, rather than update, I do a fresh install, because that kind of sets me off and without all the garbage that I've generated over the months and years maybe between versions. But then once I've done the install, then I have this checklist that I use to install programs that I like that don't come bundled with the distro, or customize the installation in various ways. So I go through this checklist and do all these things. And it turns out that some of the things can be done automatically. And some of them I do with terminal commands, so I could just write those terminal commands into a script. But I was thinking, well, can I use Vibe Coding to do this instead? And can I just tell AI, here's my to-do list, and how can I automate it? So that's exactly what I did. I went to that maintenance log, and here's an example of, in last December, I installed 22.3 of Linux Mint. And then here's my to-do list, essentially, of all the things I did to customize the system. So I basically just copied and pasted that whole list, just as you see it right there, dropped it into the chat bot, and I said, having installed a fresh copy of Linux Mint, how many of the following tasks can I automate using a bash script? So bash is a shell script in Linux, very much like PowerShell in Windows. So there's all the to-do list, and I say, what can you do for me? And it said, nearly all of the tasks, 42 or 47, can be automated in this bash script, and some of them are fully automatable, or can be fully automated, and some can't, and whatever. So just looking at a few of these things, you're not supposed to do this in Vibe Coding, but just to see what's going on. And one of the things was activating the firewall. And for some reason in Linux, the firewall isn't enabled by default. So you can do it either using the GUI down the bottom there. If you load up the firewall and just slide that status toggle over to the right, then the gray shield changes to green, white, and red, and you've activated the firewall. But you can do it with a terminal command, and you use a sudo command, a super user do command. UFW is the uncomplicated firewall, and you just say enable. You enable the firewall. So clearly that's just a task that you can do with a terminal command, and that can just be part of the bash script. Another one is that you remember my data disk, my dedicated data partition. I have to tell Linux how to use this data partition. So you can see here I'm loading it up as device SDA7, the seventh partition on my hard drive. I'm giving it the data disk mount point, and then I have to tell it that it's an NTFS directory, NTFS file system, and a whole bunch of switches there to sort it out. So basically, there's one command there in the black. That's the command that the AI bot generated. And it basically does, it copies the existing file system table to a backup file, and then it echoes that setup command to the file, appends it as a new line using this pipe right here. And then a clever one, it actually mounts that drive, so those instructions are there right now, and I can use DataDisk immediately without having to reboot the computer, which is kind of neat. I hadn't figured out you can do that. Some of the commands didn't work all that well. It wanted to install Wine, and I have this HTML editing program that I use, which is a Windows program, HomeSite. And to install it, you have to use the setup command. And so it had this command to do the install. But the problem was it just said path. Well, the path hadn't been specified, and I couldn't be bothered looking it up. And so it needed that path command to get there. So that was one that I decided I wouldn't do quite in that way. But that kind of tells you that sometimes this thing isn't quite ready to go. But by the same token, it got a whole bunch of commands that I didn't need to do anything about. I had to tweak a few of them. Some of them weren't really all that suitable, so I just dropped those and did them manually. So it's a good example of, you know, throw the book at it, see what it tells you, and then just tweak it with some additional prompts. So I ran the same thing to the Copilot just to see what it did. I thought this is kind of interesting. Alan, this is a fantastic question. And honestly, it's the kind of deep dive into an audit that fits your style perfectly. Now, that tells me I used Copilot a few times, so it's remembering what I've asked it for and what I've been doing. But it's very complimentary here. It's, you know, you're absolutely capable of this level of control. Who knew, right? So it came up with a whole bunch of commands that it could automate. It had some that were it could do partially, and some that it didn't really think it could do at all. And for example, one of them was customizing Thunderbird with all the stuff that I do with that program. It's not really capable of doing that automatically. So in the end, it says it gave me a summary. It could do it had 50 actions. It could do 35 or 38 of them automatically, and so I let it go ahead. And then it says, if you want, I can do all kinds of things for you. I can generate a bash script or some configuration files or an automation script for Wine. And on the bottom there, I can start by building a complete automated Mint post-installation script tailored to my exact setup. Well, clearly that's what I want. Just do everything for me. So I said, please create the batch script. It'll do all those good things. And, here's the good news. You can do a huge portion of your post-install, yada, yada, yada. So it says, here's a script, and you can save it as an SH file, a shell script file. These commands right here just make that file executable. In Linux, shell script files have to be executable, so those commands would do that, or you can do that with the File Explorer type program as well. And then finally, here's the script, which is quite long, so you just hit this copy button right here, and then save it to using Notepad++ or a text editor, simple text editor, save it to a file. So it starts off with a bunch of comments, and it tells me it's my script, and I did it, and I was helped by AI and all that kind of good stuff. The thing here, what I put in, I think, was I want to run this script using this command. So sudo, so that's that super user command. So the script gets run with admin privileges, basically. And then it tells it to go to the current directory. So I'm going to run it from the directory where this file is. And this is the script file for my Inspiron i7 laptop computer. Some of the scripting here, it starts off with a bunch of setup variables, and then it checks to see that we're running actually as root. So if I forget to do the sudo when I run the program, this will trap the error and stop the script, and so I know I've got to run it as sudo. Here's the one where it sends out that command to the file system table and then mounts the data disk, so I'm ready to go there. This one is very clever, I think. I use these two launchers. They're basically desktop icons which run little scripts in the background. I have one that shuts the computer down, so I double-click on the red button and things close down. If I double-click on the green button, then it restarts the program and I can reboot. It restarts the operating system and I can reboot into the other operating system on my dual boot system. Well, you notice what it does here. It does a whole bunch of things. It sets up the launcher It's got the version, the application, the name, the comment, the commands in here somewhere. Oh, right here. Here's the command to do the shutdown command now. So these are all things that I'd have to start a launcher and then start filling in all these different fields, and then I'd have to go and change the icon for the program launcher using this image file, right? By using this script, that's all done automatically. So, and it takes like no time. It's incredible, incredibly quick. And so it saved me a whole bunch of time. And it also saved me a whole bunch of time is installing a whole raft of applications programs. So here's a whole bunch of system things and different apps that I run. And basically one command here, and it's installing all of these different programs for me. So, as far as we've gone so far, we've seen two pretty useful programs, actually three, because I did that HTML file, which I actually use quite a bit. So there's some examples of the things you can do. The good thing about vibe coding is typically you want something that's a small project and it makes it quite manageable. And I'm going to have an example later on, which is, I'd say, is moderately complex. And it works really well. And the apps I create here, I don't use them all the time, but they save me a whole bunch of time in when I do have to use them. And if you have this kind of application, I mean, it doesn't have to be the things that I'm doing. What things do you have that you do manually that you could do automatically? And if you can use vibe coding, you just tell the chatbot, this is what I want, and have it do all the work. Why wouldn't you do that? So, do you have a similar project in mind, and are you thinking about entering our vibe coding competition? So there you go. I'll leave that with you.
Okay, we just had one question or sort of comment, I guess, in the chat. Did AI add all the comments?
Some of them, yeah. Some of them I did, like that, running the program thing. But as it goes down the list, it is doing a lot of commenting in terms of what it's doing. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And just an aside on anybody who's interested in the Neo computer that was listed earlier, Tech for Senior did a Neo review on Monday, and the URL is there for that. And Tom and I have been having a little bit of back and forth, and Tom was right and I was wrong yet again. System Restore can deal with other applications that get installed on your computer, and there's some links in there to some reference articles that talk about what System Restore can and can't do. So it can do more than I actually said.
Yeah, and if you go back to the chat on the Neo, there was at least one comment there that said it was old technology. Now, I don't know. It's a small computer. It's fairly cheap, so yeah. I don't expect great things of it. But if you're interested in it, certainly check the specs and what it will do and whether it's right for you.
Yeah, it's not the latest, greatest, but people are really impressed with at that price point in particular. People's
maybe just because that's priced on Apple.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Okay. One
comment about the Windows restore points. There are several things that it doesn't restore, in particular passwords and user data. So if you've destroyed user data or lost your password, bye-bye.
Yeah, and it definitely doesn't do the user hives in the registry where a lot of configuration data does get put, so you'll potentially lose all that. So this is an interesting Veritasium video that I came across. So they do long explainers. This one is 53 minutes long, so it's a long video, but I found it absolutely fascinating. So it was titled, "The Internet Was Weeks Away from Disaster and No One Knew." And so, there was a statement in it how a single hack infected the world's most important operating system. So this was a component that is used in basically every Linux distribution on the planet, and we know that Linux is used as the back end for virtually everything that is out on the internet. And so this was, it was an interesting video for sure. And anybody who's got that sort of bent towards finding out about disasters like this, by all means, check it out. And then they said, what would you do with a key that gets into any server on the internet? Because essentially that's what this hack did. And it looks like it was a nation state probably that had the patience and wherewithal to actually try and pull this off. And they got very, very close. So interesting video. And I'll paste that into the chat before I go on to the next thing. Okay, so the next one, Google Gemini Lyria. So Google Gemini can now actually create music for you. And I'll paste this into the chat as well if you want to play around with it. It doesn't seem to be as good in what I've been playing with. It doesn't seem to be as good as Suno, which is what I use to generate music. But it can do both the lyrics as well as the song. And so if you go to Gemini, and you go into the tools, you can actually just ask Gemini to create a song. But if you want to do it specifically a music, you can go to the tools and say create music. And then I went there and I asked it to create a funky tune in the style of Jason Mraz, talking about how great it is to be a member of the Ottawa PC User Group, computer group with hundreds of members, inexpensive, and you can share your collective knowledge with others in the group. So let's take a listen.
My brand new rig had me going kind of slow. Didn't know which new direction I should go. Then someone said to check the Ottawa PC Users Group. Now I'm learning from the whole darn troop. And it's inexpensive knowledge, collective and so true. With hundreds of members helping me and you. Yeah, we're the Ottawa PC Users Group.
I thought that was kind of fun.
I got a single on a pizza cube.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, next item is me too. So computer basics, selecting multiple items in File Explorer. And a lot of people actually that I come across don't know this. And if you're if you want to select, in this case here, I have an example where I want to select a bunch of the JPEGs. And I don't want to select other things. I could do them one by one and do any operations, copy, delete, whatever it is I want to do. But there are easier ways to do it. So if you want to select one file, you do a left click on it. Everybody knows that. You can select multiple files by holding down the control key, and then you click on other files. And each one of them will get selected. And if you accidentally select one, just leave your mouse on it, keep holding down the control key, click it again, and it'll deselect that file. So that you can do for these non-contiguous ranges of files. You can also select a contiguous range. So you left-click on the first file in the range, and then you hold down the shift key, and you click the last file in the range, and it'll select all the files in that range. And then you can do whatever you want, copy, delete, move them, whatever you want to do. You can actually combine the two of those, so control and shift. So here I click on the first file, and then the next file is not a contiguous range. So I hold down the control key, I left click on the next file I want, and it'll select that. Then while still holding down the control key, hold down the shift key, and then I can select the last in the contiguous range that I have here. I click on the rr.jpg. And it'll select that contiguous range, and I can keep doing that with the combining of the controls and shift. So I let go of the shift key. I can keep holding down the control key, left click on other files, so you can combine those. It gets it sounds more confusing than it actually is. Just you can go and practice in File Explorer. To select those contiguous and non-contiguous. Once you catch on to it, it is a very, very handy way of selecting multiple files. And that's what I have.
Tom says you can also use the mouse to choose files by holding down the left button and drawing over all or part of the file names.
Yeah, that's like holding down, just like holding down the shift, but it won't help you if you're trying to do non-contiguous ranges of files or non-contiguous groups of files, things like that.
Okay, thanks very much, Chris.
You can also have the check boxes too.
Yeah, I find that more tedious than anything, really. It's going in and checking, especially if you're doing contiguous ranges. You know, it's just like holding down the control key and clicking on the files. So I don't find that the check boxes to be all that useful if you have that turned on. Some people like them.
Okay, we're kind of at the witching hour, so I'm going to skip any other questions, only to say if you have questions, send them along to us, and we'll come to that in a second. Heads up, Chris is doing a presentation for the Association of Personal Computer User Groups, that's the international bunch, on March the 25th, and this is at noon. He's going to be giving his WoW backup presentation, which is everything you need to know about computer backups. Well, almost. Lots of information about why you should back up, how you should back up, when you should back up, where you should back up to, and some suggestions, I think, for maybe what to use. You have to register for the APCUG's workshop. It's not like ours. It's not open. You have to pre-register. But if you're a club member, then you're eligible to register. And I will be sending out an email when the registration's available. That will be probably next Monday. And you can sign on using that. If you're not a member, as Chris said, we have this special offer right now. If you give us $20, which is our regular one-year membership fee, we'll actually give you a second year's membership at absolutely no additional cost. So 2 years for the price of one. And if you are a current member, don't send us any money, because the board, in their wisdom, has waived membership renewal fees for existing members for the next year. So if you're not a member, 2 years for one. If you are a member, you don't have to do anything. Okay, coming up at the library presentations, Linda is going to be doing basic photo editing at the main branch on Saturday at 10:30 in the morning. And Chris, you want to buy a new computer, tablet, or anything along those lines, again, at the main library branch, but this time at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, so it's a double gong show there on Saturday at the main library. And one of the questions that came in to this survey was, how do we use AI? How do we learn AI? How can we use it to provide tutorials for kids, retirement planning? How do we use it safely? And one of the persons said, the one thing I want to know about is AI, right? Pretty general. But Chris has some presentations coming up for AI. So on Monday the 23rd, quick tips, how to use free AI tools at the Emerald Plaza at 6 o'clock in the evening, and his fun and useful tips AI at Rosemount Branch on March the 30th.
Those are the same presentation, the Emerald Plaza. I don't know where they got that title from. It's exactly the same presentation.
For different branches and different days.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
People can go to either. And if you can wait long enough, because it's going to do exactly the same a variant on the presentation, because I think it changes every time he gives it. He's scheduled for our September monthly meeting. And Linda's also busy. Linda's going to do a bonus presentation on her armchair travel series. This one's going to be in Newfoundland, and that will be on Tuesday, March 31st. And she's our speaker at the April monthly meeting. And there she's going to be talking about restoring old photographs. And it looks like that one down the bottom there is going to be quite a challenge. So we'll see how she gets on with that one, I guess. And in the meantime, our next presentation is March the 25th, which is next Wednesday, 1 week away. So if you have questions, if you want to follow up on things that we've talked about tonight, or if you have topics that you would like to share, like Chris and I have shared a bunch of things tonight, just send us a few details to the suggestion box so that we can add you to the agenda. So with that, I hope everybody's enjoyed the potpourri of stuff we've had tonight, a lot of stuff we've actually got through everything. Hope everybody enjoyed it. Thank you for attending, and I'll see you next Wednesday.
Thanks, folks. We'll see you next week.